The Reading Room Podcast.
Hello, welcome once again to The Reading Room. We're actually outside. I know readers like to conquer the great indoors, but we're actually outside at a festival, and I'm with somebody that I've been wanting to interview for before The Reading Room ever started, actually. It's Shona Lee, a storyteller. Now, if you look at our website, it says The Reading Room, where books matter. It's actually where stories matter, which is why I feel we can introduce some of our readers to a tradition that predates literacy and writing. What is storytelling?
Gosh, that's like saying how long's a piece of string, really, isn't it? I mean, it's existed in an oral format for thousands and thousands of years. In its basic form, it's a way of transferring information, social etiquette, the story of a society, a community, a tribe, and a way of teaching your youngsters not great morals, because that's not what it does, but it teaches them not to be foolish, not to be stupid. It gives them street smarts, and that's why it's existed for so long. In my tradition, I'm a Drizila, which is a very old form of storytelling, and it's passed down in my family from grandmother to granddaughter, and it consists of lots and lots of stories that you learn orally. So what is storytelling? It's an art form. It's a community endeavour, it is entertainment, education, and social history all in one, really, just to kind of put a tiny... although I could go on for hours about what it is.
So you think of, the literary novel, it's about communicating a story first and everything else that comes under that is things that the writer adds. So there might be some element of morality, there might be some element of artistry or social comment. Are you saying that although we call it storytelling, it's more than just the story?
Oh, definitely. To start with, they fall into categories. You get what they call myths or etiological tales, and they talk about creation. And when you're working with that, what I tell storytellers is one man's myth is another man's religion. So when you're talking about how the world came into being and making sense of that as part of a narrative that you can carry forward, you have legends which are peculiar to place and geography and people that give you a sense of belonging and community. You have wonder tales, what you might call fairy stories, but I hate that phrase. So wonder tales, where magic moves the plot along. And from that point of view, what that does is give access to the imagination, and especially in a time and a place where the government is closing down libraries left, right and centre, and I feel libraries are the people's university to a certain extent, what gives a class of 36 kids where books are at a premium access to the imagination? Well, oral storytelling. And then you have folk tales, which are trickster tales. There's very little magic in those, but they teach you street smarts. They teach you not to be foolish. And then, of course, urban legends, jokes, myths, riddles, and all the things that go with that. So it's really like an oral library that you hold in your head.
There are so many things that I want to unpack just out of what you've just said there. Oh, and coffees have arrived. Which we do need. Well, you need, because you've just been actually doing some storytelling. One of the things is you talked about a set of traditions from something really modern, like urban myths, going back to things like creation myths, which probably can be said to be one of the earliest forms of stories, prehistory, as in pre-written word.
If you have a tradition where oral storytelling exists and is valued, you get all those story types, because it's holistic, isn't it? You need all of those types to create a holistic, complete world. In the same way that in education, you get a rounded education. You don't specialise till you get much, much older. So if you take my own tradition, you would get the creation myths, which you would call the Old Testament, and I would call Torah or Mishnah. You get legends, you get Solomon, you get wonder tales, tales of demons and machshefts, you get folk tales, tales of Khoja who tricks authority, if you like, and then you get little bits of urban wisdom. So in any healthy oral society where you have tradition bearers, which doesn't happen that often now, you would get the whole gamut of story. The interesting thing is, societies that have been conquered tend to still have an oral tradition because they were not allowed to write things down. Their language, their culture was taken away from them. Societies that did the empire building, if you like, who were allowed access, wrote things down and lost their oral culture. So you still find very strong oral storytelling in Jewish, Arabic, Indian, even Cornwall, Ireland, Wales, Scotland, all of these places that have been colonised, if you like, you get a strong oral tradition. Places like France, Holland, Belgium, Germany, England, people that were empire builders that went in and took land, colonised land, not such a strong oral, and not the respect for it either. It's fascinating. Aborigine, Maori culture, strong oral traditions, still going today.
Urban legends, urban myths, which you mentioned, and folklore, I remember someone describing it as, because they're friend of a friend.
Yeah.
Is that part of this storytelling tradition?
At what point does an urban legend become a folktale, really? You know, and I think what you're looking at is things that have been held for vast amounts of time. You could take an urban legend and you could find it embedded in a folktale somewhere. And at some point, 300 years down the line, the stuff we're telling as urban legends will become a folktale. I remember telling an urban legend to my bubba, absolutely terrified, ran home from school and told her, and she went, Liebling, she says, that was going when I was a girl and I'm 80, you know?
I'm going to be a little bit controversial.
Bring it on.
Simply because I didn't have a great deal of respect for storytellers. And then I saw a couple of people. One of them was you. And it completely changed my view of what storytelling was. And it wasn't that I didn't particularly like storytelling. It just turned out that I wasn't that keen on rubbish storytelling. What's the difference between good and bad storytelling?
Time. Learning. There was a big thing that said, oh, storytelling is this thing that has been revived. And what we must do is go towards performing a story. And actually, nothing could be further from the truth. Actually, you need to do your homework. And what ended up was a lot of people thinking, and I'm going to be controversial now, that if you could stand up and talk, you could tell a story. And what it was a license to bore, quite frankly. And there is a skill. You wouldn't expect to watch someone play a violin and then go, well, I've watched it for a while, therefore I now know how to do that. And people say, well, storytelling in communities have happened for a very long time. They didn't have training. No, they didn't. But what would happen is you would sit round the table and if you were boring, you would just not be listened to. People are much more polite. We'll sit and listen to a rubbish storyteller and go, oh, yeah, that's very good. But actually we're thinking, I want to eat my own head and leave now. But we still applaud. We give it space. So I think it is that enthusiasm doesn't equal skill, and it's time. And it's also looking at the tradition bearers, of which there are very few, and saying, all right, so many people didn't grow up in a tradition, but all tradition means is a body of knowledge. It's something to learn from, and that's what Freedom to Tell Tales has been brilliant. Rupert's gone, you know what, I'm good at what I do, and I do this and I do that, but actually there's a tradition I can learn from here.
Now, you mentioned Rupert, who... He's waved and he's now kind of scudding off because he's going, oh no, we're interviewing.
He's gone Rupert, to get a coffee, I think.
Yes, he has. Rupert has been responsible for establishing, creating, designing Freedom to Tell Tales, which is, I'd like to think, Hull beginning that long and worthwhile journey of creating a tradition of storytelling. And you've been involved in that from pretty much the beginning, so I think you're a good person to explain what it's about and why we're doing it. What is Freedom to Tell Tales?
Well, it's very interesting. What you have in Rupert is a gem, and you have an absolute skilled artist. And Rupert came along to a thing called Tales in Trust, which is exactly what it says. You know, it's about heritage, it's about these things. And he had been asked to run this programme, Freedom to Tell Tales. I thought, oh, well, I'll go along to that weekend, pick up a few pointers, worked in community theatre for a while, and then go away and ran it. And by the time he'd finished the weekend, and I don't know many people of Rupert's calibre that would have the security and the strength of character, the right word, I don't know, to say, he came up to me and he said, you know what, I don't know anything about storytelling. Will you come and run the module with me? And for me, that was so exciting that someone that was starting something from the roots up, rather than go, yeah, I know about this, actually went to a tradition bearer and said, will you work with me on this project? And I think that's why the project's been so successful. I've worked on projects like this all over the world, and the whole project you should be incredibly proud of, because what you've produced on the whole is an absolute hub of good storytellers, because we have worked for nearly a year teaching them what makes a good story, what makes a bad story, what works in literature, and you will know this as a book person and a writer, is what works in the book doesn't work on the tongue. You have to keep it linear, you keep description to a minimum. All of these skill sets that have been honed in tradition bearers because, you know, not because they're highfalutin or anything, because if they don't get it right, they just don't get listened to. We started working with groups running 5-week sessions and having a storytelling at the end of it. And the whole thing wasn't to have this, we are going to now perform a story, because actually that is where least is known. Performance storytelling is cabaret storytelling, and that's lovely, it's very good, but to do a performance storytelling, you just need to know one story well and perform it. To be a storyteller, what you need is a skill set, you need a range, you need a repertoire, and that comes with learning. So we started running these things, we started running the sessions, we're now looking to move it on, but what you've got now in Hull is a bank of really good local tellers, and what they now need to do is build up their repertoire, and I'm really excited about that, because they're talking about running a storytelling club. There are clubs all over England, you can do club swaps, and I think the thing that has been absolutely groundbreaking and wonderful is, you know, rather than going, oh yes, let's get a book on how to do this, they went to the horse's mouth, to where it starts, and it's been absolutely exciting and fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. And we are not in Hull, we're just outside Hull at the Cornucopia Festival, which is in Burton Constable Hall. Any listeners that haven't spotted the fact that we might be at a festival or some kind of heavily musical event must have cloth ears by now. Hopefully they can hear us talking over the sound of admittedly great music. Storytelling seems to really suit festivals. Why is that?
I don't agree with you.
They don't suit festivals.
I think they do suit festivals, but they'll suit anywhere.
Yeah.
A good storyteller can tell in a pub, in a bus stop, in a living room, at an event, at a festival,
I guess what I was thinking was not so much that festivals are one of the few places where storytelling can go, but there are other forms of story,
yeah,
like film, like readings, etc., etc. You know, more literary forms that don't seem to find a place at a festival. And I'm wondering it's because there's something about storytelling that means that it earns a place more than other story and literary forms.
I think that's a good point. I think maybe at a festival, A, you can create a space where people want to listen. B, it is incredibly transportable. It is designed to be told. And again, if you look at most tradition bearers, they are parts of minority groups that have been fairly transient. Tinkers, Roma, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Lakota, Sioux, Pai, Mumbai, you know, the Panwani, they are traditions that have literally been nomadic. So in that sense, it's very easy to pick it up and put it in a tent, because it doesn't require sets, it doesn't require lighting, it doesn't require a lot of faff. But also, I think when people come to a festival, they are stepping between the worlds in a way. You're leaving who you are on the 9-to-5, and you're prepared to embrace things that maybe you wouldn't embrace normally. You can literally see people transform. It's like they've stepped into the other world. They've got face paint, and you can see them, and you can go up the motorway, and you can see them almost shedding this skin. As they move back into their everyday life, it begins to slough away, and what they're left with is the memory and the magic, and I think that's what suits storytelling. It's a way of walking between the worlds. Not in an airy-fairy way, in a very real way. You know, my Bubba told stories in Auschwitz, for goodness sake. She didn't sit there going, I must just have the right... You know, she told for her life. And they have a power that Disney, you know, my bugbear, has taken away from them. But if you hear a good storyteller tell a good story, they're powerful things.
Yes. I was going to let you get away, but there was something there that I wanted to... Only because you're being really generous with your time. You're between two storytellings. Fairy tales, which I know you don't call them fairy tales, but you know what I mean when I say fairy tales. Have they been completely stripped of their energy, power, meaning?
Pretty much so. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard me tell the original Cinderella.
Yes, and it completely blew me away.
Not all of them, but they tend to go two ways. They either become Barbie saccharine and completely disembodied from the original versions, yeah, which were there to deal with the undealable, ask the unaskable, and give voice to the voiceless. And you know what I mean by that. The other side of the coin is they get pulled apart by academics who then analyse the symbolism, the archetype, what this story really means. And then you get these very verbose, in-depth, absolutely psychological analysis. And that's going the other way, because it's like dissecting a frog to see why it jumps. You might understand the mechanics, but that frog's never going to jump again. And I think the middle ground is held by the teller of good story. You have a foot in both camps. You understand the pedigree and the lineage and the power of that story, but you deliver it in a way where somebody can enter into that world and take what they need from it.
You said something to me once, suddenly Aesop's fables made sense, which was they're not morality tales. And, you know, folk tales and a lot of stories, they're not morality tales. The stories aren't about realism, they're about deeper truths, and the characters aren't necessarily there to be people, they're there to be archetypes, yeah.
But I think you have to tell them in a way that people can walk in that world and believe in those characters, because that's what makes us recognise the experience in ourselves. But yes, the whole idea of putting a moral on the end, that's a very recent thing. Even Aesop didn't put morals. That was added on afterwards. Because the thing is, I can tell a story, and there might be three people that are listening that could take three different meanings from it. The minute I put a moral, I shut the whole process down, and it becomes my agenda and not the listener's agenda. And it's actually not about the storyteller. Actually, it's about the listener. It's not about what I want to do. It's about what the listener needs to hear. I mean, if stories were about morals, I think I've said this to you before, then Jack and the Beanstalk would teach us that it's all right to invade another country, it's all right to murder, it's all right to steal, and it's all right to be stupid, because you will get rewarded. Did the people that heard Jack and the Beanstalk believe it? No, they understood the deeper things that were going on there. And I think, you know, we tend to patronise these things. And a lot of tellers patronise them. They tell as if they're doing the story a favour by telling it. But actually, if we just let go of all that rubbish and just tell honestly, then what you get is this amazing, rich world.
Yeah, and you do. Shona Lee, it has been an honour and a privilege to have one of the most important people in changing my view of what a story is, what literature is, and what it can be. So it's been an absolute honour to have you on The Reading Room. Thank you so much.
Me. Thank you very much.
This podcast was made possible by the James Reckitt Library Trust. The Reading Room is produced by Creative Projects Limited in association with the Hull Library Service.